one all, and welcome to another week here at the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. It's a Monday, which means it's time to, you know, cast off the relaxation and all of that of Saturday and Sunday. But Mondays can be fantastic too, thanks to Francesca Fiorentini.
Let's go, Francesca. What up, John? Sup, Dragon
Squad? I like that sweater.
Thank you.
That's cool. It goes well with your background color too. Glad to have you here.
Good to be here.
News continuing to be as chaotic and weird and unnecessarily bizarre as it is, but very glad to have you here as we launch into another week of what can possibly happen. We talked a little bit about some of the Monday morning news on the pre-show, which everyone should tune into, like about 50 to 60 minutes before the show. That's as accurate as I can be. But for instance, Francesca, we mentioned that Biden did the sort of thing a president can do. He just signed a thing, and now the transgender military ban is gone.
Yep.
That's good.
Yep.
I'd like to see that.
No, yeah, it's course that's divisive according to the media, and he wants unity, but this is so divisive. I was calling it like moving into a crime scene and being called divisive for mopping up the blood. And being like, no, it's not divisive at all. I'm literally just cleaning up this crime scene.
It's like, it's super bloody in here. Come on, can we do something about this? Yes, and America is unfortunately, and quite literally, very bloody up in here. So hopefully, this is the sort of, I want. I want at least this every day. And he can do it, he's the president. He can deliver it. They got the Senate, they got the House. They can eliminate the filibuster. They can do it. Let's start having those conversations.
Yes.
But anyway, thank you to everybody, regardless of where you're watching, for watching the show. Appreciate that. Please hit the like button if you haven't already. And as we go along through this hour of news, we'll be reading your comments, your tweets, your chats, and all of that. A couple of quick little network updates before we launch into things. One is, you know that we're on Instagram, at Instagram at the Damage Report. You can definitely check that. Thank you to everybody who pushed us past 10,000 followers over the past few days. That's pretty awesome. We have a lot of fun on there, sharing dog photos, and it's mostly a lot of dog photos, which is the best part of the internet, and we want to be a part of it. But also, did you know that we're on TikTok? You should. We've said it a bunch, but anyway, we're on TikTok, and probably by the time I'm filming this, we're gonna move past the 10,000. So TikTok apparently kind of a big deal. So go on the TikTok, search for. Go on the TikTok. I'm 50. Anyway, go on TikTok and search the Damage Report, and I'm there wearing that suit, but doing TikTok dances. So you can definitely enjoy that.
Oh,
I always cross my arms on TikTok. That's my thing. It's probably not going to catch on. But anyway, thank you for following us there as well. Oh, also, did you know, by the way? Did you know? We've got a new mug. People have been requesting Dragon Squad mugs, and we've got them. Look at that.
Mm.
Whether you get the kind I hold, the same kind, but with her holding it, both are good kinds.
Her? Oh, suddenly I'm a her. Okay. Suddenly that, you know, that thing. Yeah, you're gonna have that one or me. Thanks.
I'm not starting the week well, admittedly. I'm so happy to have you here, but I'm not. Demonstrating it.
You're doing great.
Oh God, make that into a commercial. Okay, I guess we're gonna talk about news. I don't see how, but anyway, we're gonna try. So let's start off on a bit of a down note. Many, many people have died over the past year, needlessly, before their time. Over the weekend, we had another with Larry King, the legendary broadcaster, one of the biggest names in media and interviewing of the last 50 years, 100 years, did pass away at the age of 87. I want to give you just a few updates in case, you know, we have a lot of younger audience members who may not be that familiar with him. He hosted Larry King Live on CNN for over 25 years, interviewing presidential candidates, celebrities, athletes, movie stars, and everyday people. He retired in 2010 after taping more than 6,000 episodes of the show. But by retired, it means he left that show. He kept broadcasting up until the middle of December, actually. A statement was put out by Aura Media, which produced Larry King Now, which was the final iteration of his show, saying, "For 63 years and across the platforms of radio, television, and digital media, Larry's many thousands of interviews, awards, and global acclaim stand as a testament to his unique and lasting talent as a broadcaster." They didn't put out any kind of cause of death, but he was hospitalized in late December with COVID-19. And so it's not difficult to imagine that that might have been a factor, certainly didn't help. So I'll have a little bit more details for him. But Francesca, I know we don't talk a lot about deaths necessarily, but he was a pretty big one in media, which we're sort of part of. So I figured we should definitely mention it.
Absolutely. I mean, to be broadcasting for that long and then to keep going, I think that obviously if you are at CNN, 25 years at CNN is enough. Like, you probably want your own thing after that long. But Larry King was sort of, I mean, up there with obviously like the great interviewers and, you know, but a different style. I can't, you know, Charlie Rose, may he be canceled in peace, but and like, you know, Barbara Walters and like someone who who made you feel incredibly comfortable, like when I was interviewed by Larry King. No, but when, you know, he had a familiarity about him, he was warm, he really wanted to it was very empathetic, I think, and that's why people liked him. And then he had that like buttery radio voice, you know, that the baritone Larry King voice. And yeah, I think that what COVID-19 is doing also is cutting lives short who that didn't need to be. Even though someone is old, doesn't mean they didn't have like another 10 to 20, you know, and especially people who are working at, you know, in their late 80s. And that I think is a huge loss. Is we've been somehow hardened to the idea that at-risk groups are more expendable, and they're not. And these are elderly folks who have so much, had so much more life to give. So anyway, gotta honor them as they, as and remember them for all that they did.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, like, I think it was the governor of Texas early on there saying, you know, like, you know, your grandparents have had a good long life, but if I had to sacrifice mine, I would. This is what they're talking about, basically.
Yeah.
Creating a situation where there's so much COVID out there that inevitably Larry King can get it. And again, we don't know that he died from it, but he had it. He was 87 and he died. So I'm not a mathematician, but I can solve certain equations. But anyway, in addition, he did have health problems over the years, multiple things that would lead him to be higher at risk, including his age. He suffered several heart attacks. In 1987, he underwent quintuple bypass surgery, inspiring him to establish the Larry King Cardiac Foundation to provide assistance to those without insurance. More recently, in 2017, he was diagnosed with lung cancer and underwent surgery to treat it. He also, by the way, last year lost two of his adult children within weeks of each other. His son Andy suffered a heart attack, his daughter Chaya died after being diagnosed with lung cancer as well. So, you know, obviously a very sad last year in addition to all of the obvious ways. But yeah, he had a very interesting place in media, being effectively just an interviewer. Like, he just wanted to learn from as many people as possible. He apparently said quite often, "I've never learned anything while I was talking. I just love what I do. I love asking questions. I love doing the interviews." And I was lucky enough, you know, over the last few years, I was on his show a number of times. So, you know, one out of every 10,000 of those interviews was with me, and I had a great experience with him. And he never really pushed anything on me. He just brought me on he wanted to know what progressives thought about the news.
Nice.
And yes, sometimes he put me on with absolute troglodytes from the right. But he did have me on, and not a lot of people in the media have left us on. So that is good to see. In any way, quite a career, sort of speaks for itself, and sad to see him go.
Yeah. Also, I just want to tell everyone to watch the clip where he interviews Jerry Seinfeld when Seinfeld ends. It is the funniest piece of interview pretty much ever, John. You have to see it because Larry goes in and clearly hasn't been super briefed on it, you know, and how it ended, and not maybe not a Seinfeld fan, which of course for Jerry Seinfeld, who is so up his own ass, is like, you know, that's like a huge no-no. Like, Jerry is like, "You don't know who I am, I'm king." And especially then, and Seinfeld was not canceled, but Larry's like, "So was the show canceled or did he?" And like,
how does he not know?
And Jerry's like,
Seinfeld.
But it's, what's funnier than Larry getting it wrong is Seinfeld getting so upset and so like flabbergasted that this person wouldn't roll out the red carpet and not know, which is just mwah when someone is, you know, just needs to be taken down a peg was very fun.
Down a peg. Yeah, it's like, dude, I still really like Seinfeld, the show. It was very good. It is, though, it's a 90s sitcom about nothing. Like, and he was good, he was funny, but like also like, I think Larry David deserves quite a bit of the credit for that. Like, if somebody is gonna be full of themselves over it, it's Larry David and apparently Steve Bannon, who was apparently involved in it, but whatever. Okay. He also, and as people are pointing out in the chat, he took Dave Rubin down a peg. Have you seen the video where he's being interviewed by Dave Rubin? And he takes a personal call for like 4 minutes live on air during the interview.
Amazing.
It's like they were on the same network at one point, you know, when Dave Rubin was popping around before he decided he was gonna be, you know, an alt writer or whatever.
Sure.
And he just takes the phone call.
I love it.
Hilarious.
Thank anyway. You. Rest in peace.
Thank you. You did a great service to humanity.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Dr. Fauci has continued on from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. Dr. Birx, not so much. And they were the two sort of front-facing scientific members of the Trump team until Scott Atlas, the guy who doesn't understand disease but thinks it's great for a lot of people to get it, took their spots, kind of. Well, Fauci came out of it with a great reputation. Dr. Birx, apparently a little bit less so. And so she did an interview with Face the Nation addressing some of those concerns, giving a little bit of information about what it was like behind the scenes with the Trump administration dealing with the pandemic. And we're gonna evaluate a few of her answers. With the first being trying to get an idea of, from the inside, how serious did Trump actually take this thing?
Do you think the president was just distracted by the political implications in the campaign?
You know, I always wonder that. And I mean, the worst possible time you can have a pandemic is in a presidential election year. I think the White House personnel were very focused on this pandemic in March and April. I think once the country began to open and it was clear to me that they weren't going to follow my really gating criteria that I had worked hard on.
How to open restaurants, how to let people
dine indoors. I combined all of that together for these great gating criteria. So in calculating everything with the slow reopening, I didn't think anyone could get to phase three until August. And you can see in the states that followed.
Okay, so how serious do they take it? Look, it's just, it's kind of a stupid question to ask because we know how serious they took it, not at all. But she says that in March and April, they took it pretty seriously. I mean, I remember like after 9 days, he said we're gonna be reopening on Easter because it's gonna be gone by then.
Yeah, like, what point? When?
April was not a month where like they closed it out strong and then they lost some steam in May. She's giving some insider access, which can be useful for the historical record. But even now, in an interview, which I think a lot of people are seeing as an attempt to sort of clean her reputation, that's sort of carrying water for the Trump administration to pretend that they gave a damn for even 2 months.
Yeah. Oh man, Deborah Birx is a very conflicted and interesting character in all of this because she was pretty much the only one who could get through to Trump because he liked her scarves and he thought she was very elegant. Literally, that's what he said. Mm-hmm. So he was mad because I believe the CDC had gone over his head to announced that it was, you know, the pandemic was far more serious. And so then he shut his ears to all the science because he was worried about the stock market like everyone was who doesn't have a soul. And then Deborah Birx was the only one to get through to him. And I think she had a different role to play because whereas Fauci was demonized, it was seen like Deborah was like, you know, the Trump whisperer. And I think she understood that too. So I'm not gonna say that she was, you know, I think like sort of colluding or condoning his lack of response, because I think she was also put in a horrible position, but I also think she was not brave. I think the word for her was definitely not brave. I think the word for Fauci, brave. Word for Deborah Birx, more of a go along than brave. And I think this moment required one to be more brave than a go along. Anyway, we can continue.
Yeah, we will. And we have more of her. Yeah, I think. Look, there is an alternate world where Fauci could have done more. I don't know that I believe it would have mattered aside from possibly getting him fired earlier, or getting fired, I should say.
Right.
I don't know. It's possible he could have done more. And I am trying to be fair to how we evaluate Fauci versus how we evaluate Birx. But I feel like there are some pretty big differences that are going to be hard for Birx to get past. But anyway, she is offering us that behind the scenes information. Let's get a little bit more here. Were there COVID deniers in the White House? Another one of those kind of obvious questions, but here's the response.
Are COVID deniers in the White House?
There are people in the White House, and I think people around this country, because I've had the privilege to meet them and listen to them and hear them, because I wanted to hear what people were saying. There were people who definitely believed that this was a hoax.
Why?
I think because the information was confusing at the beginning. I think because we didn't talk about the spectrum of disease, because everyone interpreted on what they knew. And so they saw people get COVID and be fine.
Okay, so Francesca, the issue that I have with that is, it still feels like it is trying to be too nice to these people to say, yes, the White House, which has access to more information than literally any other house in the world, they were like, the information was confusing for them, so they were like trying to work through it. No, they were misinforming the public about it. They yeah. were the ones going on Fox News to talk about how it's just gonna be like the flu and it's not a big deal and it's China's fault and Kung Flu-y and all that. Like, they weren't just passive receptacles for a maelstrom of confusing facts. That was the American public, in no small part because the White House was lying to them.
No, exactly.
They were like, the purveyors yeah. of misinformation from the very beginning.
Absolutely. I think the follow-up is, who are you talking about? The question was people inside of the administration. So I assume she's talking about the administration. And again, the amount of leeway and the amount that she is giving to the administration for like, well, I mean, people were just, you know, wrongly informed, or they were interpreting their own set of whatever data, what they had read, and they saw people, and it's like, no. You're the White House. You are in the executive branch. Like, you don't get to do that. Like, you don't get to just interpret the tea leaves like the rest of America. You have to put out the information, like you're saying. And I don't want to be partisan about it, but it really feels like she's got a soft spot for the administration. Like, it's clear to me that, like, if you stick with that administration, if you do not resign in disgust at that point, it's because you kind of like them. Like, you want them to win. Maybe you voted for Trump. You know, I'm getting a lot of Karen vibes. I'm just gonna say it. Like, that's sort of what it feels like. And I don't think everything has to be partisan. In fact, I think it should not be partisan. But like, given that reality, that the Republicans made reality have a partisan bent, meaning if you believe that it's real, you're suddenly a Democrat, then I would say Birx was very much partisan in the Republican sense.
Yeah. Look, I can't confirm or deny her Karenhood. I have no idea. I don't know what's in her heart or in her voting history. But we can evaluate her responses. And what she did. And I can try to be understanding about, you know, it's entirely possible that Trump would have reacted very differently to her doing the exact same thing that Fauci might. That's possible.
Yeah.
The guy who believes that her value is based on the scarves that she wears and how elegant she looks might be ready to cast her aside at a moment's notice. That seems like that might be true. But hundreds of thousands of lives are on the line. So again, everybody who stayed, we have to evaluate what was their rationale for staying, and much more importantly, what was the effect of them staying. In Dr. Birx's interview with Face the Nation, a couple of questions came up specifically about Donald Trump and his involvement in the pandemic. So first of all, the fact that, remember, he got COVID. How did that happen?
But how did the task force allow the president, who calls himself a germaphobe, to get COVID himself? How did that happen?
There were only two people who regularly wore a mask in the White House. Myself and Tyler Ann McGuffrey, the support person that I had from HHS.
So the staff around the president was not wearing a mask. He's the commander in chief. This is a national security risk.
I mean, that's sort of like, yeah. Now, there were follow-up questions about, you know, did you make it clear that they should need to be wearing masks? And I will say, as critical as I'm being over in this segment, everybody knew that you had to wear a mask. Like, everybody a month in knew that you had to wear a mask, and the people who didn't made a political choice. Their identity became wrapped up in not wearing a mask. And so I don't think that if Birx had gone up to Stephen Miller and said, hey dude, it would be better and more responsible for you to wear a mask, I don't think he would have. But yeah, she's confirming it is as bad as it looked from the outside. It wasn't that Trump refused to wear a mask in public because he thought it would make him weak, but behind the scenes he was a germaphobe, so he wore it. Apparently no, all of them either genuinely believe that masks are a Bill Gates conspiracy to infect your blood with demon semen, or like they were just that selfish and it was their political identity.
Oh my God, I want that demon semen, because then like maybe I could get, you know, child support, live off of that. Sorry, that was gross.
The
John
palace
said it
in
first.
Hell waiting for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was the Trump's favorite doctor that he retweeted or whatever, was the one who used to talk about demon semen. Anyway, okay, so in terms of, we get a little bit more information from behind the scenes. You appreciate in her perspective?
I guess it's a thankless, you know, it really is a thankless position that she was put in. And I think most people probably would have resigned at some point for their own sake to sort of like save face. And it would have, I think, told the country that this, it would have said a lot to this country, because I think that then you don't have pretty much any scientist or any physician, anyone who is qualified supporting the administration. And instead, I think what happened was, is that by her remaining, she ended up validating where he was coming from. And I think that that's, again, I don't envy that position. I think, because you imagine you're there, you're like, well, okay, he listens to me because I am a blonde woman with nice scarves, but I also sort of know what I'm talking about. How do I balance this? What do I do? I wanna help people. I wanna actually get information out. But I think, and I know we're gonna talk about this, as soon as you see that that is falling on deaf ears, then maybe you should move along.
Well, what if there was a moment that made very clear that he didn't know nothing, he wasn't gonna learn anything, he didn't give a damn about anything. Turns out there was a moment like that. And so she was, of course, asked in this interview about the drinking bleach moment.
Some people felt you became an apologist for President Trump. They look at that moment in the briefing room.
Then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?
You were sitting there and he looked at you and he asked about ultraviolet light and heat.
See?
And
that?
And you start talking about fevers. You
no,
didn't
see,
say
this is the no.
Deborah, have you ever heard of that? The heat and the light relative to certain viruses, yes, but relative to this virus?
That is a treatment. He was not speaking to me. is what when you talked about, was I prepared for that? No, I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't even know what to do in that moment.
Sometimes people say, well, Tony Fauci, when that happened to him, he would sort of gently come back up to the podium and set the record straight.
Well, he was given the opportunity to do that.
And you don't feel you were given the opportunity to respond?
Not until he turned to me and said, could this be a treatment? And I said, not a treatment.
Okay, so there's more to that. And she says that originally he was talking to someone else sitting next to her, but he asked her a question very specifically about vis-a-vis in regard to the disinfectant. I know. If you had stood up and said, well, that's crazy, he would have fired you. But this was an official COVID press conference where he was telling people, maybe we put the light inside. And that was actually happening as the pandemic was warming up. So I would want people to think that I wasn't as involved as I obviously was too, but we remember what happened.
No, I mean, exactly. And also people died because they injected and tried to ingest bleach, ingested at least. It had consequences. Not correcting that record, as stupid of an idea as it was to attempt to drink bleach to get rid of coronavirus, she didn't correct the record. And Burke's not standing up and saying, no, let me just clarify. I think that we're all, like, you can couch it, we're all looking at experimental treatments, and the president, you know, praise him, but he is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you can't just stand up and say, like, you dumbass. You can't say that. Yes, I get it. But you got to do something. It's crazy talk. And we focus on the bleach because it's the most insane. But how many weeks of hydroxychloroquine?
Oh my God.
How much conversation, how much time during the pandemic was wasted for that? And the back and forth and all of it. And the thing is, look, so that's all that I really want to show from the interview. It's not to say that she didn't do good things behind the scenes. Maybe she did. Maybe it is possible that she did. But I'm going to remember some things like the bleach thing. And I'm also going to remember back when relatively early in March, the first 2 weeks of the lockdown, when she said of Trump, he's been so attentive to the scientific literature and the details and the data. I think his ability to analyze and integrate data that comes out of his long history in business has really been a real benefit during these discussions about medical issues. And so that's why he then went on an interview and said, I've had people tell me that I understand this better than anybody, better than a doctor. I should have been a doctor. Like, whether this is misinforming the public or causing Trump to think he's better suited to deal with this pandemic and doesn't need the experts than he actually was, that effect doesn't seem to have been positive either. And when you come out in the first few weeks of a pandemic that ends up killing nearly 500,000 people so far, and you say that he's got this great mind like a supercomputer, then maybe people should have been more critical of Trump early on. Maybe they should have demanded more, but they didn't because some people are misinforming us. And I'm not saying that she was in the top 5 or even the top 20 of misinformers, but she was part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remember just like a couple of weeks ago when Tucker Carlson thought it was hilarious that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was worried about being killed during the murderous Capitol riot? Yeah, well, now we're finding out that a 34-year-old Texas man has been arrested for taking part in the storming of the Capitol and posting violent threats, including a call to assassinate Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So I don't think that this is necessary to have made a congresswoman's concerns about being assassinated by violent radicals a serious thing. But knowing that there is a person who had felt totally comfortable posting that he wants to see her killed was storming through the halls of Congress, what do we think would have happened if that person had come across the representative? Tucker Carlson wants you to believe they would have just had a laugh or nothing at all. I kind of doubt it. Anyway, a little bit more information about this individual. His charges include knowingly entering and remaining in restricted buildings without lawful authority, violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds, obstructing and impeding an official proceeding, and performing acts of civil disorder. Miller is one of at least 119 people facing federal charges in connection to crimes committed during the Capitol riots. But you should also know that out there in the relatively new breaking news area is the idea that the Capitol Police might not actually press charges for people who are not directly able to be linked to acts of violence. So just the breaking of the property, the storming of the building, the roaming through the halls, hoping that you can assassinate these people. That might not be enough, Francesca. Which notably is not how they've treated protesters in other situations in the Capitol.
I just one more week in America. Oh my God, here we are. But yeah, just if this were any other group than a group of mostly white Republicans who want to overthrow the government, it would all be criminal trespassing. The amount of arrests, I don't know how many times do I have to say this, like the speed at which people would have been like, I mean, tear gassed and rubber bulleted down, the amount of state violence that would have rained down on anyone that we've seen raining down on people, people who've protested for the ACA and protecting Medicaid have been treated with more violence than folks just roaming around with Nancy Pelosi's files. Like, insanity. And once again, a lot of people have said this. Barbara Smith, who's a wonderful writer and academic and activist, black feminist, she said, look, white supremacy has finally come for Congress and they can't sit on the sidelines anymore. It's been coming for activists. It's been coming for black and brown people, for Latinos, for Muslims, for immigrants like this. And now it's here in Congress. So let's understand what we're dealing with. But I just want to say, like, we've all had a wake up call, but the one thing that I think we should know is that, like, Republicans, like, and the whole, I want to drink liberal tears and just make them cry. Like, there's actual violence behind that, that it isn't just about making, making Democrats cry and hurting the squad. It isn't just about cajoling them. It isn't just about supposedly holding them accountable, as some from the left would say. No, this is about actually trying to target them. And I think we have to understand that it would have been so much worse, and we've talked about that, if they had run into AOC or Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib or Ayanna Pressley or any of the other happen to be women of color who are part of the squad.
Yeah, and their constant fears of being killed. This is like a particularly intense moment, but I'm sure Ilhan Omar has thought many times over the past couple of years that she could end up being killed because of what she's doing. Thank you to all of them. Great, their political positions, their political advocacy, very valuable. Their bravery in the face of this constant demonization, this constant unfair, misogynistic, racist demonization of everything they do and say is another thing that they've had to deal with. So, very brave of them to continue at all, and I hope that it doesn't get so bad that we lose them. I don't even mean the violent way, although that's obviously a concern, but AOC has talked about not being sure that politics is actually her future. And I'm sure that this is a big part of that. She might not run for election at some point because of how grotesque and extreme this entire environment is.
Yes.
Anyway, really fast, I just wanted to show you the evidence. So he was one of these that was very easy to track down because he just posted about how excited he was that he'd broken the law and gotten in there. He responded to AOC on January 6th with assassinate AOC. So he also threatened a US Capitol police officer, saying he planned to hug his neck with a nice rope. And so that's the sort of person that was roaming around there, a guy who's perfectly happy killing this female politician, killing a Capitol police officer. Those violent extremists that went to the Capitol, they're still out there. They don't know exactly what their next move is, but they're retooling and looking for another way that they can terrorize America. So just be aware of that.
Yeah, yesterday on the Bituation Room, my podcast, we had someone on from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we were talking essentially about, look, this person posted on Instagram, right, that they like the desire to hug someone's neck, a Capitol police officer's neck with a nice rope. Like, that was Instagram, owned by Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, 2.9 billion users on that platform. Dude is a billionaire himself, can't figure out his bangs. You've heard of him. He talks like this. And There is no incentive. Yes, they've done a good thing by kicking some of these crazies off their platform. There's no incentive for them to actually keep them off. And so long as we have big tech, so long as they can continue to monopolize this industry, we're gonna have hate and false information amplified and amplified and amplified even more. And so it is super important that we remember that, for example, this was a great example that she was telling me. She was like, look, if there's a copyright infringement on this show right now, you start playing Macho Man, right? You know, this video will get taken down in 2 seconds. But if we start inciting violence against AOC or anybody else and start calling for assassination, that'll stay up. That's fine.
Yep.
Because they're not afraid of AOC suing them. They're afraid of, you know, like RCA or MGM or whomever, like a record company suing them because they've got actual money. AOC is one person. So let's just remember that this is all part and parcel of the fact that we need to take down big tech. They have no moral center whatsoever other than making money.
Yeah. I'm not as convinced by this argument because you're talking about some sort of antitrust effort against big tech to protect regular people and not just to let like white males like me monetize our platform. And so I'm not as interested. That's really what I'm in this for.
Yeah.
Anyway,
free speech.
A good point. That's what free speech is. You know, we're just a few weeks out from the January 6th incident, and from that night, there have been attempts to rewrite what it was. Ignore the people who died. Ignore the cop who was beaten to death by these MAGA people, these Q people, the Boogaloo boys and all that. Ignore that. It wasn't that big of a deal. Mock anyone who takes it seriously. Well, we have gotten a lot of updates since then about how much worse it could have been than 5 people dying. And so let's give you a little bit of information about that. Some weapons that were found by people who attended that: a crossbow, assault rifles, knives, tasers, baseball bats, bear spray, a cooler full of Molotov cocktails, ingredients, and IEDs were among the weapons that were brought by Trump supporters. Capitol Police also reported that the insurrectionists used their own pepper spray and mace against them during the riot. You might recall a video we played, I believe last week, of them chanting as they assaulted a cop to shoot him with his own gun. But some just decided to bring their own guns, in fairness. You had the devices, Molotov cocktails tucked into mason jars, mixed gasoline with styrofoam. The mixture, a common home recipe in extremist texts like the Anarchist Cookbook, makes an improvised incendiary substance similar to napalm that can stick to skin and surfaces while burning for extended periods of time. So some of this we'd known about. I didn't know about the crossbow previously, but you had a lot of people that came armed, not just to see the fancy artwork, not just to represent their constituencies, Josh Hawley would say. They came with an assault rifle because they had an inkling that they might need to use an assault rifle or a crossbow or knives or baseball bats or Molotov cocktails or IEDs. So yeah, it was serious.
Looks like the FA is much more dangerous than the anti-FA.
Yes.
In all of this.
These could be.
But once again, it's who is wielding them. I believe there was some sort of open carry rally. I can't remember where it was. There was like an open carry rally in Virginia recently, and like hardly anyone showed up because of COVID. And DC, by the way, doesn't have an open carry rally, open carry policy. And the only people who were arrested at this open carry rally were the 4 black men who were going in attendance. Of course. Of course, the double standard is incredible. This is Alton Sterling, who was killed in his car by police trying to reach for his license that he had to carry his weapon. This is not about free speech. This is not about the unheard masses. This is not about fake news. This is not even really about platforms and tech. This is about white supremacy. That's all it's been about. This is about keeping or making America white again. That's it. And it's such a condemnation of our law enforcement. It is such a condemnation of the justice system in this country. So I am with Representative Jamal Bowman and Representative Cori Bush and others who are really trying to root out not just the insurrectionists who were in the streets and performing, you know, who were doing this, but also the people in Congress who were egging it on, who were completely in it for this kind of violence. Of course, they knew where it would end.
And let's remember, just to buttress her point about the fundamental fact that white supremacy is at the core of this, as it is so much of what the right wing gets up to, is what was their argument against the election? It was that no, the people of Detroit, their votes don't count, and the people of Philly, their votes don't count, and the people of Atlanta, their votes don't count. Often the rural areas, the white voters, those can count, but black people living in cities, their votes don't get to count. And if you try to count them, we will come and we will kill your politicians, your black and brown politicians. We will target them for assassination. That is what this is about. Do they want power? Sure, but they want to uphold a white supremacist system. That's what they want. That's what they were trying to do with the legal argument, as ridiculous as it was, and when they actually attacked the Capitol.
And they lost even in a system that already upholds a white supremacy, a system that was already established to protect slaveholding states. Like, you, how can you lose in this system that's already designed for you to constantly win, like the electoral colleges, and you still lose? It seems like, so then you have to resort to violence. But Gay, I think you're just going the way of the dinosaur. Like, bye, let's just shed this. We're shedding our exoskeleton, John. We're moving on. We're shedding the white hood. But you know, I think this is what's so sad about this moment is, like, this is why we can't have anything nice. You know, I feel like once again, we live in the future and we live in the past right now. You know, it's like we're living in 1860 while we're also trying to get a Green New Deal to live in the 21st. You know.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is the special little moment we are in American history.
It's a great time. It's a great time. And they can't even release Black Widow or the new Bond movie. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, fresh off her gig lying professionally, wants to serve as governor. She's apparently gonna be running for governor of Arkansas. She calls the position the last line of defense against the radical left in Washington. Let's stop there for a second. Look, there's no radical left in Washington. And I will say that if there was a last line of defense against it, it wouldn't be governor of Arkansas. What role does the governor of Arkansas have on the crazy commie socialists over in DC?
You don't know, John. There's special. There's badges. There's paperwork.
I just imagine someday, like, AOC is about to sign, President Ocasio-Cortez is about to sign the thing that's gonna ban cows. And they're like, wait, we haven't gotten it checked by the governor of Arkansas yet. That's not
have you run this by the governor of Arkansas? Quick.
Oh my God. Anyway, her father was governor from 1996 to 2007. And she became press secretary for Donald Trump after Sean Spicer resigned in 2017. So I want to give you an idea of what her candidacy is going to be like. As if you don't already know, she said this: with the radical left now in control of Washington, your governor is your last line of defense. As governor, I will defend your right to be free of socialism and tyranny, your Second Amendment right to keep your family safe, and your freedom of speech and religious liberty. Our state needs a leader with the courage to do what's right, not what's politically correct or convenient, or based in truth or reality. So now she is gonna be running, and people had been expecting this for a few weeks. So what is her record? Well, she lied for Trump for a couple of years and Republicans loved it because she lied and she would spit in the face of the media. So there's that. She worked on some political campaigns because of her father. She started a consultancy campaign that worked on campaigns, and that's it. And governor of an entire state. I don't know exactly what the role of governor of Arkansas is. I imagine it's a lot of stuff that's pretty important to the state. Now, she portrays her experience as, I've been tested under fire, successfully managing one crisis after another in one of the most difficult high pressure jobs in all of government. At the table with President Trump, confronting our most dangerous adversaries like China and North Korea. No, you didn't. You didn't. Being tested under fire, sure, sure. Your job was to lie for a guy who did and said crazy things. Defending that is legitimately a difficult job. I would not have lasted 5 minutes doing it. So she gets credit for that. That isn't actually managing crises. That's kind of distracting from public relations crises that your president own gold himself on. But anyway, Francesca, what do you think? Does any of this matter? Like the fact that her job was basically just lying for the president, and that's the record that she's gonna try to parlay into governor?
Yes, it absolutely matters. It matters that people are willing to elect leaders who are more focused on burying any problems they have under the most amount of sand, including their own heads. So whatever the voters of Arkansas have to deal with, whether it's climate change or income inequality or the housing crisis, I will make sure to distract you with something else. Like that is really, I mean, and that is what voters, if you are at this point, Republican voters are going for that. They want the leader to, the leader that will most lie to them about reality, that will most deflect onto the backs of black people and immigrants and the so-called radical left. That's what they're signing up for. That's what fascism is, really. That is what it is. It's saying, I want to buy into an unreality that is the most authoritarian and the most violent possible. And that's it. I just want to buy into a set of beliefs. I don't want to actually buy into the world we currently live in. And that's very scary. It's also interesting that just over in Georgia, naming the radical left and socialism over and over again didn't win. And
that's true.
Yeah, and so and that is thanks to grassroots organizers who made sure that those real issues were at the forefront of the campaigns of, you know, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. And in Arkansas and in, you know, in states all over this country, that's what it's going to have to be. It's going to have to be fighting against this BS rhetoric with real issues and like actually listening to people. But yeah, there's nothing, she's got no experience whatsoever. And it speaks to a broader point, right? Which I like your take on, which is what do we do with all of these Trump grifters that spawned off of this putrid administration, you know, just like, you know, mushrooms on moldy socks. Like what do we do with these new fungi that are still around? You know, this black mold on our nation. I'm just gonna keep going with
it. Yeah, okay, until I vomit.
Yeah, yeah, until you puke and then I will have won. No, but like you know, we wanna ban them forever, right? This is the idea with actually, you know, making good on that 14th Amendment when it comes to current, you know, lawmakers who incited insurrection and helped with that, right? Like there's an amendment where it says you gone, you bye-bye now. So what happens when you helped this insurrectionary violent president maintain his, you know, house of cards or lies or whatever the hell? Like, you know, it's like, what is our recourse? And I think there's been a lot of ideas floated about how we can lobby around, you know, making sure these people only can dance with the stars and maybe not even that, but definitely not hold office again.
Yeah, I think that she's gonna run. And I think, look, as much as I'm mocking the ridiculous record, and even like my one quality is that I told lies that you wanted. I was the front man for that. Like she didn't do that for like 3 months or longer before she eventually left the job. Like she ended the one thing that her job was, the press briefings. But anyway, that doesn't mean that she's not gonna win, because everything that Francesca said about what they want, what they're all signing up for, they are signing up for that. And we can fight back, but Arkansas also isn't Georgia, so it's gonna be an even bigger fight. And in terms of, you know, how she's gonna try to, like the distraction and all of that that Francesca was talking about, you saw the announcement quotes. It's radical socialism tyranny thing somewhere else. Not actually anything having to do with Arkansas's issues, because a cursory search shows that it's 43rd for economic activity, 32nd for economic health, 50th for innovation potential, has one of the worst state economies in the US. You'll note that she's not really talking about fixing that, because she is a Republican, so she doesn't care about fixing any problems. She's gonna tell you that they're coming to put trans people in your bathrooms and they're gonna shut down your Second Amendment Bible rights. That's what she's going to say, and there's a very real chance that it will win. So maybe the joke will be on us. Unfortunately, it's also probably gonna be on Arkansas. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I'll say is we obviously need better. I hate this line. I've always hated this line, but it's the first time I've actually felt it. We need better Republicans too. We need an actual Republican to run, like a McCain, you know, who was principled in some ways. But I think, I mean, And we need Democrats to run, but I also think we need better Republicans to run, because you're absolutely right. There are people who just will not vote for a Democrat no matter what, you know? And one thing I'm hoping is that Trump makes good on his third party threats and starts the Patriot Party. And then we win.
Yes, because that is unfortunately how it works. Until you change the way voting is done, that's the effect it would have. And I'd argue that's the effect that he wants it to have. Welcome everyone to the weekly top 10 list. I almost said the Monday top 10 list, but sometimes it comes on Tuesday, so it's weekly. But welcome either way. I'm Johnny Arola, joined as always by Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
Hello, everybody. This is how I talk in extra time. All the subscribers, I can be real. This is my real voice. I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm doing.
Imagine if it was.
I just want to talk like Merlin.
Feel free. So this is just for our tier two and tier three YouTube members. So thank you for, if you're watching this, you're either one of those things or you've stolen it. But either way, thank you for watching. I'm happy. So this is the first of what I hope becomes a regular thing, which is a member submitted request for a top 10 list. So in this case, we got a comment from Electric Blue Omelet Dragon, who requested favorite things you've done, discovered, or learned during quarantine. And I thought, wait, something positive about the quarantine, not on my watch, but I couldn't come up with anything better. So I'm totally joking. So we're gonna do that because I love that as a request. So these are the top 10 good things that we've done to get through or learned during the pandemic. And Francesca, would you like to start us off with your number five?
Sure. God, there's so many, but I think cooking, I think changing our relationship to food has been really vital for me. I obviously think that restaurants should get, you know, small business loans and assistance and help and like get paid to close their doors to keep people safe right now. But I also think that generally, our relationship in the United States to food is one of massive, you know, eating out and consumption and like takeout and, you know, all that. And I think just having to, you know, adult up and buy a bunch of food and learn how to cook new things and like, you know, oh, hey, I, you know, made whatever, like changing up the repertoire a little bit, challenging yourself and like kind of using it as a moment to do probably what the healthiest thing for the planet and our own bodies is, which is really to cook. Like Michael Pollan, you know, the author who has written so many great books about it, is basically like, you gotta cook. That's kind of the main thing. Yeah. It's like in all these cases. I'm not saying I don't do takeout, and I'm not saying there isn't massive amounts of trash right now. But cooking is one of the things that I think I did try to bake. I baked a birthday cake for my boyfriend, and it was so funny. This is quick, but we love the Great British Baking Show. And
me too.
Yes, anyone who has a soul and a heart does. And so I was like really, really, you know, stressing about the recipe, and I was trying to follow it to the T and letter. And I put the cake in the oven, and I was like, yes. And I turn around, and there were two eggs just sitting on the on the countertop. Like, hello. What about
I've
me?
I've done that.
And then I was like, oh fuck. I was like, oh no. And then I took it out of the oven. I put the eggs in and like mixed them real quick and put it back in. No. It did not work. So I had to do what they do in the show, which is completely start over, no time, but you start over and it worked.
Wow. Wow. Did you just kneel on the floor next to the thing, just looking through the glass? Because that seems to be a big part of the process.
Yes. I said, disaster.
We've done some cooking, not as much as maybe we should have. We've started having weekly pizza from the Dough Room, which is the best pizza in LA. Oh my God, it's so good. I was cooking. I was trying to be helpful. So I cooked and I realized that I had substituted the olive oil for vinegar I put in instead. And it turns out that's different. That's a very different thing. So anyway, but that's not my number five. My number five is, this is my learning one. And it was sort of how you talked about with food, learning what it is I actually need. Not what I think I need. Like I thought I needed to buy clothes all the time, I guess. Or, you know, like go to movies. And I still miss that, but doing okay. Like I liked eating at restaurants. but I'm doing okay. You know, like I can do takeout. Like it's a pruning back of all of the things you grow accustomed to and realizing what you actually value and what you need to still have in your life to be happy. And it was less expansive than I thought it would be. And that was a good learning opportunity, I think.
Totally. Like pants, don't need them.
Don't need them.
Pants.
Bart's not picky and no one else is here. So
yeah, it's all just from the waist up. I do feel like the waist up has been getting all the shine out of this pandemic.
After the pandemic, we're just showing butts. That's it.
You know, it's pantsless, nothing but butts. Everyone just walking around. No, I think that's a really important one. And I think that was maybe my number four is travel. I think this feels like a test run, and I've done, you know, interviews on this network about the ways that it really is a moment for us to rethink our relationship to the massive fossil fuel burning of traveling all the time. And I haven't been on a plane in March. It'll be a year, I guess, or maybe it's been a year now. And I think that I have gone on smaller like trips and vacations that are driving distance away, which is far better for the planet. And so just the idea that like you gotta travel to some far flung country, and it absolutely is part and parcel of, you know, being in the United States and being an American with, you know, miles and sort of an entitlement to travel around the world if you are able to. And that's seen as super normal, and it's not, right? And actually for the most of the world, it's not a normal thing to just travel all over the world. And in fact, you can discover stuff locally. So I think being more local, seeing the little wine area in Southern California I never knew existed, or you know, like and supporting local economies. Like it's all about local economy. I mean, we live in this moment where like everyone's like shop local, but I'm gonna go to Bali.
I'm gonna go shop local in Bali.
Yeah. And so I think we really need to rethink our, you know, in the same way of consumption. I can't say that I have stopped buying lots of lipstick, but I will say thinking about, you know, yeah, the amount that one needs to travel is important. Yeah.
Well, my number four is actually related to travel as well and shopping locally, because I have a few things that are sort of new traditions that either I have developed or myself and my wife have developed as a result of the pandemic. And one is bicycling. We had bicycled before the pandemic, but starting relatively early into the pandemic, because we couldn't go to the gym and we were feeling a little bit isolated, we started going every Saturday morning. We would take a long bike ride, sometimes down to the beach, sometimes all throughout the town. And we did it every Saturday, sometimes more than once a week. I started bicycling to work a good bit, and we just got really into it. Like we saw so much of the neighborhood that we hadn't seen. Riding all over the place, riding to go pick up breakfast or to go to the beach to get like a protein shake or something. And it didn't stop me from gaining a ton of weight during the pandemic or anything, but it was fun. And it was carbon neutral, I think.
Yes.
And yeah, it was a good experience. And I'm hoping to be able to continue to do it. Like it's a little bit cold right now, but once it warms up just a little bit, I'm gonna be biking again. And that's something that I'm hoping I will keep coming out of the pandemic.
Just going down to the beach to get a protein shake with my wife, you know,
in Bali.
Like, it's so great. And
it was fun, whatever.
I'm kidding. That sounds
Sunday, actually.
That sounds lovely. I am afraid of the bicycle, so good for you. I'm not a good biker. I'm not a good bike rider. I see a car and I'm like, then I go into a ditch. No, I constantly think I'm going to die when I'm on a bike, but yeah.
Bike lanes, we need more of them.
We do need way more bike lanes. Three is, I guess, similar to that. Three has to do with relationships. I think this is very, you know, sheltering with a significant other really is really, really, really hard. And I think a lot of people are either like, moving in together and having babies, or like getting divorced and breaking up. And it is a very interesting moment. And I think one of the things is, you know, we just sit on the couch and like watch a lot of TV together as couples nowadays. You know, Netflix and chill is just like Netflix and die slowly. And so I think it is important to do new activities with your partner, you know, and whether that is like, you know, a 1,000-piece butterfly puzzle that I still haven't gotten over and I will never do a puzzle again, or like playing music together, or just doing a new thing together other than watching movies and your stories is really good. So I think that has been a good lesson for me, is like, oh, when you can't plan for like, oh, I'm going to, we always do this delayed gratification. We're going to have a vacation in the future and we're going to do this in the future. Yeah. And in the future, we're going to, versus like right now, what are we going to do this day, this week that is new and different? How can we carve out time for ourselves? Even though we're stuck together constantly, like switch it up. And I think that's really nice.
I agree. I mean, I'm probably more okay with the stories and stuff like that, because it's a chance for my brain to shut off and just to absorb. That's what I want. But totally, yeah, I do agree. And now I feel a little bit awkward about my number three, which was another tradition that we started, which is first every Friday night, and then after some issues with, or it was first Saturday nights, then some, after some issues with neighbors, it became Friday night. We do an outdoor movie night together where we rotate choosing the movie and we make dinner and we do popcorn and we've done s'mores and stuff like that. And we started that immediately in lockdown the first week. And one of the women who lived in the main house, I live in the guest house behind it, she joined us until she eventually moved. So it's been a great, like we watched a bunch of movies that we otherwise wouldn't. It's an opportunity to learn a little bit about the taste of the people that you're with. And we've kept that up until now. Like we just, what was my Friday movie this last week?
I don't Sense remember. And Sensibility. That's what I want you to watch.
Show recently.
Sense
anyway.
And Sensibility with Kate Winslet and Emma Thompson. Let's have a good old girls cry. Yep, I will make you watch that.
I watched Little Women. Is that close enough? Come on.
No.
Anyway, but it's been a good tradition. It is, you know, absorbing, but it's good. I like it.
No, anyway, it's adorable.
What's your number two? And we're gonna keep doing that after pandemic too, by the way.
Number two is remembering that government matters. That like, you know, we can't smash the state just yet, because we need it to tackle giant crises like a pandemic. No, but I think it really, it is, obviously this is a little political, but it's very much a moment to think about, oh yeah, there are institutions that matter in the country, like a healthcare infrastructure, like emergency response infrastructure. Like, you know, I think that if we had a stronger federal response, stronger infrastructure, but also stronger like community response. You know, I think that perhaps some of the communities that are doing the best are the ones that have that were already strong to begin with. And so it's sort of this pitch to like, in this moment, which is so awful, where we can't really know our neighbors because we can't really get too close to them, I do think it is important to, since we are so hyper local, hyper in our homes, kind of, you know, as we start to, if we open back up or if we start to actually tackle this, to like remember that we need to call on an immediate and very physically close support network of a neighborhood, of a community. So I think this is very much a pitch going forward to strengthen those communities. And so, yeah, government, whether it's, you know, a community, small neighborhood council, or whether it is the federal government, matters. All this stuff has the potential to bring us together so we can problem solve.
Yeah, yeah. I hope, by the way, that some of these are very particular to us. I hope that that's for a lot of people. That'd be a useful one, the reminder of how serious this is and how significant it is. My number two is more personal, and it is the experience of doing the show at home and the way that the show has changed. In some ways, you know, we're teetering on the brink of falling apart and not even really being a political show anymore. And I don't know how it's sustainable, but yeah, it just feels a little bit different. Like I would love to, some parts I wanna go back. I wanna have Francesca in studio when we're talking to each other. I wanna not exclusively be talking to Skype, but I feel different doing the show. I feel more comfortable doing the show. We're closer to the audience in a lot of ways. All of that, those are good changes. That have, you know, developed, you know, in parallel, some almost immediately after this thing started, some more recently. And so that's been a great experience to watch that go. There's I hope coming out of the end of this, if that ever happens, we'll be able to take the best of both worlds. That's my hope.
Yeah, absolutely. So like a little bit more, you know, cash. Little cash, but still in the studio.
I'm not saying I don't ever want to wear a tie again. Like I do miss that, but the relationship can stay more cash.
Yeah.
I'll be right up in your face, but maybe wearing a tie at some point.
But I think it's fun because you're also kind of finding, it's an interesting time for this show because you're finding a voice as a relatively new show. Although, wow, how it's exploded. You're still finding the voice. And so I think it's kind of nice that like, it's a silver lining of this whole thing is that you found this like voice within a pandemic that happens to be more true to your voice and your the complete Johnness and not just it sounds like jaundice, but it's not. It's the Johnness.
It's not. Although I have had that back when I was a vegetarian. But yes, exactly. Thank you. What's your number one?
Number one is just lots of touchy feely, but it's just sort of remembering the people in your life who matter most to you and your loved ones. And that is parents and good friends who you always say you're gonna call, but you never really call, or you ignore their phone calls, or you don't text them back on time. And just making sure to connect to people because the future is so uncertain and we are so distant from one another. And once again, with this sort of like, rather than making plans to see you on that day or plans to see you at the holidays or plans to call you just kind of, you know, weekly or, you know, regularly, don't ever tell my mom I said all this because she's gonna hold me to it.
the weekly?
Yeah. Talking to your parents and your loved ones and remembering sort of who in your life matters most to you, who has shaped your life, who has been there for you and in the, you know, in the sort of rat race of being in a career and being busy and being, you know, constantly bombarded with the news. We can easily forget those people who make us who we are. So I've kind of just been like finding myself at that 4 a.m. sort of like, you know, wide awake and like, yeah, these are the people I love. These are the people I miss. These are the people I want to tell them that I care about them regularly.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. That's really sweet. The only downside to that one is it's going to make mine seem shallow. Because it ain't anything about any of that or about any people or anything real or like emotions or art. Or
is it about Marvel?
All that is true. What's that?
Is it about Marvel movies?
No, it's not about watching Marvel movies. Okay. Can you imagine? Well, like I watched Civil War and I was like, this is really good. Let me change it. I don't want to
I wouldn't put
Marvel
it past movies. You.
Mine is almost as shallow, but no, it's a thing I started doing, another tradition. And so I don't even know, probably like 7 months ago at this point, as many people who watched the show know, myself and two of my friends from back when I lived in Austin, we started an online writing group and we started meeting twice a week. And as a result of it, I am almost all the way through a novel that I've been writing during the pandemic. I took about a month off for a bit there for reasons I can't really get into, but just yesterday I wrote a little section. And when it's done, it's gonna be bad because I'm still new to all this.
No, I've only written that's not shallow at all.
Well, it's not that's about like growing reconnected with my mom or anything.
No, but it's but like nurturing your hobbies and your interests and your talents is not shallow. And a writing group, that's amazing.
Well, thank you. It's been a good experience, and all of us have gotten a lot out of it. I think, I guess in some way it is, but in most ways it ain't art exactly. Like I'm writing a fantasy novel, but it's been a fun experience. And I've wanted to write like my whole life. That's why I wrote my first novel, and I just haven't put nearly enough of my actual life into doing it. And this pandemic gave me a little bit of the free time, or at least free mind to do that. So that's one of the biggest things I've done during the pandemic. Not quite done yet, but neither's the pandemic. So
that's, I know there's like, there's this really selfish part of me that's like, oh good. So until, if I have until July when most people will be vaccinated or August, then I can still write some stand up because my God, I have not written enough. You know, like when everything reopens and I'm still doing old jokes, I'll be like, damn it. But yeah, no,
it's. You're doing jokes about how great it is to hug random people or something. It just doesn't work anymore. But anyway.
No, those are gonna work forever. Are you kidding me? Pandemic jokes, we're gonna be talking about them. First of all, if you don't like pandemic humor, bah, who cares? Like, you don't like humor. It's gonna be all that comics talk about for a very long time.
Probably.
Cause it's something we all went through together, right? So
we did.
Slash are still going through.
Are people going to lie about having been anti-maskers someday? Like, when we're 70 and you find out that someone was an anti-masker, I'm still gonna judge them in 50 years, I think.
This is why the internet is the worst and the best thing ever, because there are receipts of them losing their cool and going ape at a Trader Joe's. So we have that on tape, Karen, and you can't escape that. Although I do want sort of the repentant Karen club at some point to form, and you know, just in the ways that like some Q people are like, I just thought the prophecy was gonna come true and maybe I was lied to. Like, I want that.
If they can wake up, we will welcome them home. Well, anyway, thank you, Francesca, as always, for guiding us along this top 10 list. Thank you, everybody, for being members. If you have suggestions for top 10 lists, you can, of course, respond down below. Remember, if you're a new member who has access to this, you have access to all the past ones. We have a playlist set up on the channel, so it should be fun. And we've got a lot of plans for the future. So hope you enjoy it. Thank you again for your support. We'll see you soon. Millions of American students are crushed by student loan debt. That is nothing new in America. But what is new is that we have a president who has, at least in theory, promised to do something about it. But is he actually going to? And if so, for how much? How much relief is actually coming? Joining us now to talk about both what might happen with Biden and the general topic is the Debt Collective Organizing Director and Biden Jubilee Striker, Umi Hawk. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. So before we launch into Biden, what he's said, what he might do, can you tell us a little bit about the Debt Collective?
Absolutely. The Debt Collective is a union of debtors, and we are coming together to demand things that we used to have as public goods in this country, and also things that should just be public goods in this country, like college for all, Medicare for all, and housing for all. Really building a society that where we can all truly live and thrive.
And so you mentioned that it's a collective of people in debt. When we transition to Biden and you know, what he might do with student debt, you have this Biden Jubilee 100. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so last week we launched our Biden Jubilee 100 campaign, and that is 100 folks from around the country hold student debt, and we symbolically represent Joe Biden's first 100 days in office, and we are all on debt strike. So I am one of the Biden Jubilee 100. I have over $70,000 in student loan debt, and I refuse to pay until Joe Biden commits to not just pay some small amount of it, he commits to pay to cancel all of it. We're demanding full student debt for the 45 million people in this country that whole student loan debt.
So let's talk a little bit about that and what might come. So Joe Biden has talked about this in the past. Last year, he tweeted, we should forgive a minimum of $10,000 per person of federal student loans as proposed by Senator Warren and colleagues. Young people and other student debt holders bore the brunt of the last crisis. It shouldn't happen again. So here he's saying 10,000. And after the election, he sort of went back to saying 10,000, even though there are others saying unlimited debt forgiveness. Even Chuck Schumer said 50,000. So I haven't seen any indication from him that he's willing to go higher, but do you hope that that might happen? Are you seeing, based on the action that you're undertaking, that there might be sufficient pressure to get him to go higher?
I think we can go higher. When our communities are in a situation like none other, with the pandemic, with debts, with work, with people losing homes, and those are obviously the people who are struggling the most right now. So what we really need right now is full-scale cancellation and abolition of debt. And the only way that we'll be able to get Joe Biden to do that, and for the Democrats to take this seriously, is for us to continue to build pressure. That's why we've gone on debt strike. That's why we're talking to folks in our communities. That's why we're getting more people involved in this campaign, because we know how many people this impacts. All of the data shows that this is an issue that bipartisanly is supported. People across the country care about this issue. We just need to make that number higher. The fact that Joe Biden has talked about it is a great step forward, but we're gonna continue to put pressure and to make sure that he hears from us so that that number goes up and up. And that's why we were asking for other people to join the campaign as well and to get involved. involved, because we know that it's going to take a lot of people power to win this. But we also know that people need this support right now. Trying to change the lives of 45 million people, it's going to cost a lot of money, but that's all money that can be taken away with the stroke of a pen. This is actually an authority that the president already has. It won't change anyone's taxes. It's a really simple way to provide relief to millions of people, and that's why we're calling full cancellation.
And just to be clear, in terms of his authority to do this, there's nothing that says the president can cancel $10,000 of debt, but if it goes to $20,000 or $50,000, it needs to go through Congress, right? In theory, any threshold he sets up is one that he is setting up.
Absolutely. The president has the authority. It's been granted to him from Congress. So there's no need to talk about what the figure could be. He literally has the power, and he should. That's what people need right now.
So, you know, I have a lot of other questions I want to ask you, but in terms of, like, so you said that you hold $70,000 in debt. So let's say in theory, he could cancel 10,000 or he could cancel all of it. What difference will that make to your life going forward?
I mean, it'll make a huge amount of difference. Actually, we have a whole website, the Biden Jubilee 100 website, where you can go on the site and actually read the personal stories of everyone who's on strike and what it would mean if we had that debt canceled. And what you'll see is probably some of the people who are watching the video, the things that people have put on pause or put on hold as they're paying off these debts. The ability to buy a house, the ability to start a family, the ability to really live and thrive, not to be stressed out every single day because of these hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars that you have to pay every month. Many people having loan debt who didn't even graduate from college, there wasn't even that benefit of having a degree or something like that, but those are still about pay. It's really limited generations of people. In this moment, there is an opportunity for Joe Biden to do something that would transform so many people, and in that way would also just provide so much benefit to our economy and our local communities. If I didn't have to pay my loan debt, I would be able to buy a home or my family better or support my local business, or all of these things that actually just mean that money is going back into our community, back to our country, and helping so many people thrive right now.
So, and thank you so much for talking about that. I think thankfully a lot of people in the audience probably also are struggling with student loan debt. So for them, it's very easy to imagine what that world could look like. As you pointed out, this is very popular. It's one of the reasons Biden ran on it, is because it's so popular. But I have noticed whenever I advocate for the cancellation of student loan debt, there's an argument that I often hear from a certain sort of person. I'd like to get your response to it. And that is that, but I already paid off my student loans. Why should I care if the government pays off other people's? What do you think about that argument?
I have a lot of respect for people who have paid off their student loans if they chose to do that. But this is actually not an individual problem. It's not a situation where we're talking specifically about my student loan debt, although it can really feel like that. It's actually a problem with our political system, higher education in this country. If we want to live in a society that really values people and really makes sure that we are set up so that other generations of people can go to school and really thrive and really contribute, then we need to make sure that people can afford to go. Currently, student loan debt is the cost of social mobility in this country. It's not possible to pull oneself up by the bootstrap. It really does cost poor people money, literally just to get ahead. And if that's the case, then we need to make this system fairer. It needs to be ways for people to be able to achieve their dreams without having to get saddled in tens of thousands of dollars worth of debt, which is fading all of these other implications on our society and our community. So I think that it's not just about this debt cancellation. It is about what are they all taking as a country to make sure that higher education is a public good. And the first step in that is candidate, and then moving us all toward a trajectory where higher education can be public good and affordable for everyone.
You know, finally, I wanted to ask you about one angle that you don't often in the media see talked about when student loan debt is talked about, and it's one that you talked about in an op-ed that you wrote recently for The Guardian, which is the link between student loan debt and systemic racism. It's something I actually just saw, I believe it was earlier today, new representative Jamal Bowman was tweeting about that. So can you tell me a little bit about the link between those two things?
Yeah, like many things, the way that student loan debt and the changes in what I was talking about before around, you know, higher education being a public good in this country as it used to be maybe 40 or 50 years ago, all of those changes really come about because of reactionary Republican ideology and lots of policy changes that were impacted because of that. So during the Reagan era, we saw cuts in federal education spending, which was then duplicated with cuts in state spending. So the rise in student loan debt is actually a recent problem in our country. Within the past 10 years, it has increased by 100%. And so all of these things are really tied to systemic racism in our country. The Reagan era was when more people of color, more black and brown communities were actually going to school. You can see an increase in enrollment around that time. And you can also see an increase in people of color taking out debt. And so there's a very close correlation where if you are someone who's going to school for the first time, you're going to need many families will need to take out that student loan debt to be able to go to school. If the cost of tuition is rising, then there's actually lots of data that shows people who are holding student loan debt are Black and Brown people, other people from communities of color, and they're the ones who are struggling the most and defaulting on their loans the most as well. You know, canceling student loan debt does not equal racial justice, but it is absolutely a step in that direction. It will close the racial wage gap and be able to provide support to a lot of communities of color that are really struggling right now. And so it's a real opportunity that Joe Biden has to not only provide relief to all to millions of Americans from across the country, but also to really address a problem in this country around racial justice and the experience of people of color trying to go to school.
If someone watching this wants to find out more or support the strike, what can they do?
Yeah, they should definitely check out the Debt Collective. We're on all of the social media channels on our website as well, and get involved. We've got the website that I mentioned where you can read the stories of the strikers and learn more about that. We have a petition. You can join the union directly on our website, and you can join the campaign as well. We're going to need people power to win this, so highly encourage it. Definitely get involved. And yeah, love to see you.
Umi Hawk, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.